Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Spook Me. I'm Nicole.
I'm Emma.
And today, we are back on my bullshit because we are doing an unsolved, multiple, gruesome murder case. Because I can't get enough of them, apparently.
Fantastic.
I'm just a sucker for the unsolved. I can't help it.
You know, also, I used to, like, hate them because I didn't know what happened, but I'm really, honestly, I'm getting there.
I like them the most because I can kind of make up my own idea of what happened.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Because I like to pretend sometimes that I can solve these cases myself.
Right, exactly.
So, I also, oh my gosh, I just have to say that, I went pee right before this started and discovered a very searing sunburn on my shoulders.
I thought you were going to say something else. I didn't.
But I was like, how did I get a sunburn? Because I was outside for like 0.2 seconds today. And then I was like, oh no, I had my sunroof open.
Oh, gotcha.
For an entire 2-hour round trip. So, not great.
That's not good, okay. Is it?
Anyway, that's a sidetrack, but
that's all right.
It was great. Anyway, life of a redhead.
Anyway,
today, okay. I have to warn you guys, this case is like kind of gruesome. Actually, it's pretty gruesome.
It's so pretty fucked up.
If you're eating, I say don't. That's all I have to say about that. I mean, you can eat up until the actual murder part, I guess. But I just stop eating. Okay.
Yeah.
But today we are headed back to the 80s in Kenny, California, to talk about the Sharp family murders, or as it is more famously known, the Keddie Cabin murders. But before we get into the case itself, let us get to know the family a little better. The mother of the family was Glenna Susan Sue Sharp, who was born...
What a name.
I know. She's got 100 of them. She was born on March 29th, 1945 in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Oh.
I know. Hometown.
Back in Massachusetts.
She had 5 children, the oldest being John, who is 15. Then, a year later, came 14-year-old Sheila, 12-year-old daughter Tina, Rick, who was 10 years old, and last but not least, there was little Greg, who was 5 years old.
Little Greg.
Sounds like a prince's name.
Like Prince George. He's so cute.
Oh my god, cute. Speaking of princes, I'm already getting off on a sidetrack. But I recently, as of last night, finished the show The Great with Elle Fanning.
You finished it?
I finished it in 2 days. Because I've got nothing better to do. Yeah. But it was really good. And I do have to say, though, the ending. I was, like, very disappointed because it's very anticlimactic. But I was well, of course it is. I should have known because I know the history and, like, what actually happens with Catherine the Great. So I was like, why did I think I would be surprised? But anyway, go watch it. It's really good. It's on Hulu. Anyway, back to Sue. The mother was most known as Sue, so that is what we're going to call her for the rest of the case. Sue had just recently separated from her husband, which prompted her and her 5 children to leave their Connecticut home. She decided that she needed to be quite a ways away from her past life with her husband, and that she also wanted to spend some more quality family time, so she headed to Northern California, quite a ways away.
Literally across the country.
I know. Where her brother had been living at the time. Specifically, she went to stay in Kenny, which is a small rural town near Sienna, Nevada. There was a resort in this town called the Keddie Resort Lodge. And there were, of course, multiple different cabins at this resort, but the family decided to stay in Cabin 28. After this story, I have to say, I don't know how much money you would have to pay me to stay in a cabin in the middle of a forest. If you look it up, like if you look up where the Keddie cabins are, it is just forest.
No, thank you.
It's so frightening.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Me either. Sue did not have the easiest life in her nice little forest cabin. Sue was the one supporting her family, and they had been living paycheck to paycheck. They were also living off of food stamps, a stipend she received for being enrolled in a federal education program, and checks she received from her husband's work in the Navy. But overall, the kids and Sue were able to find happiness in their little cabin despite their financial troubles. On April 11th, 1981, John, the oldest son, had been visiting with his friend Dana Hall Wingate. That, talk about a prince name.
That's a man? Oh, I forgot. Yes. Boys can be called Dana. I forgot.
My uncle, Dana.
Oh, I'm sorry, Uncle Dana.
How dare you? Anyway. Dana was from Gassner Park in Quincy, California, about 5 miles away from Keddie. Around 1:30 in the afternoon, Sue and one of her daughters, Sheila, went to pick up the two boys to bring them back to Keddie, where Dana was planning to stay the night. But around 3:30 p.m., the boys were apparently pretty restless and I guess had better things to do in Quincy than in Keddie. So they both hitchhiked back up to Quincy, where it is suspected that they were going to meet friends there. The two were seen in town by a lady named Donna, who gave them a ride to another friend's house. And then they were also later seen heading to a party at Oakland Camp in Quincy. Typical boys.
Oh, yeah.
Typical teenage boys.
In the 80s.
Truly. I also, okay, can I just say, hitchhiking? Yes,
I know.
Why?
Don't do it.
Don't. Why? Especially in a highly wooded area. Like, I understand that there obviously are towns and there's roads, but like they're also completely surrounded by woods. So fuck that.
It was the time, I guess. I mean, I know no one really hitchhikes anymore. But that's why people don't get murdered anymore.
I mean,
well, I mean, not as much.
Not okay.
Like, I feel like so many murders happened in the 80s and 70s, and that's because everyone hitchhiked. That is the sole reason, and that's it. Right?
Fine. But also, did the mom just like let them do this? Was she just like, oh, they're just fucking kids. Let's just let them do it.
Yeah, probably. Probably literally exactly that.
Great. Well, the boys were not the only kids who had things planned that night either. Sheila had made plans to stay over at the Siebold family's cabin. Nice name. That was just one cabin over from cabin 28. Both John and his friend Dana returned to cabin 28 later that night. But being the mom that she was, Sue stayed home that night with the company of Rick, Greg, and their friend named Justin Smart. Sheila left her mother, brothers, and their friend at about 8 o'clock p.m. and headed over to the Seabolt's cabin. Tina, the younger daughter, had already been hanging out with the Seabolt's, but about an hour and a half after Sheila arrived, she left and headed back to cabin 28 at 9:30 p.m. The entire family went about their business for most of the night, but little did they know the horrors that were about to unfold in their peaceful little cabin 28.
On April 12th, at about 7 in the morning, Sheila made her quick walk home from the Seabolts. When she opened the door to cabin 28, the once peaceful cabin had turned into a slaughterhouse. As she entered the house, she discovered her mother Sue, brother John, and his friend Dana in the living room, brutally murdered. Each of them had been bound by electrical tape and wire. They all had varying degrees of stabbing, beatings, and strangulation. The attack of the three of them had been so aggressive that there was even blood spattered on the ceiling and pretty much on every other inch of the house, including little Tina's room and the back steps of the house. The amount of blood throughout the house, it was suspected that the bodies had been moved and rearranged from where they had originally been murdered. She was found on her side near the sofa, and she was naked from the waist down. She had been gagged with her own panties and a blue bandana. This was secured in her mouth by some tape. She was partially covered with a blanket and a sheet from Tina's bed. This led investigators to believe the person who did this tried to hide whatever injuries she had sustained, but this proved to be unsuccessful, obviously. She had also been stabbed in the chest, had her throat slit, and was bashed on the side of the head with what was believed to be the butt end of a Daisy 880 BB gun. Can I just say, the thought of getting my throat slit,
literally,
oh my god, I know.
I feel like I can just feel it. When I think about it, I feel like I'm feeling it on my throat. And it makes
ew, that just gave me chills. In American Horror Story, it happens all the time. You could play a complete drinking game with it.
For how many times someone gets their throat slit.
That is, everyone do that. I mean, you'd be drunk, plastered.
I just feel like that's such an awful way to die. I mean, I don't know if that was the cause of death, but like,
I mean, you can't survive a throat slitting, I feel like.
Right.
Ew.
I'm sorry. Anyways.
No, I agree.
John was found closest to the front door of the house. He was face up and his hands were completely covered in blood. And he was bound by medical tape. That's weird. Medical and electrical tape?
I know.
He just had a stock.
I don't know. Maybe they're similar thing? I don't know.
They're very different. Anyways, his throat had been slit as well, so great. And Dana had been found next to John and was lying on his stomach. His head was half on and half off a pillow, but was brutally mangled, and he had also been strangled by hand. His ankles were tied by electrical wire and tied together with John's ankles. Oh, my thought is that, why, like, they're all murdered in such different ways, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that weird?
It's very weird. Like, Dana's head was mangled. I mean, he probably was beaten, but like,
yeah,
his throat wasn't slit. Why was John and Sue's throat slit? And why was
exactly? I don't get it.
And why was Sue hit with a BB gun? I mean, maybe it was to, like, to subdue her or something, but I don't know. It just seems so all over the place.
And
it
you almost know makes what? Me
think like it wasn't just one person.
Right. And I also, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but the BB gun was never found.
So how would they know if the exact model of the BB gun?
I don't know.
Was it like something that was in the cabin?
I mean, maybe, but they like didn't list it in the weapons found.
That is so weird. I mean, so, there's no way you can tell like by someone's wound, like what kind of gun it was.
I know. It's bizarre, right?
I mean, maybe you could say it was a handgun or, like, an assault rifle, but I don't think you can tell the exact model of a fucking BB gun.
There are so many things about this case that do not make sense. Like, it drives me up the wall.
Great.
And none of it really gets solved ever, so you're shit out of luck.
Fucking shit out of luck. Just be frustrated. After the autopsies were done, it was determined that all three of them had sustained blunt force trauma to their heads. The weapon used to inflict these wounds was a hammer or multiple different hammers. What?
Mm-hmm.
The autopsies also revealed that their cause of death would have been the combination of the stab wounds and the trauma to their heads. Along with the hammer that had inflicted the head wounds to the three of them, two bloody knives were found. Both hammers and one knife were found on a small table in the kitchen. One of the knives was a steak knife that was found next to John's body. This particular knife was used with so much aggression against the victims that it was actually bent in half. Okay, I just need to say something. You know, some steak knives are pretty weak.
I do agree with that.
But still, that's scary.
I also have broken many a metal spoon in my ice cream before.
Okay, yeah. If it's, like, really hard.
Yeah. So, like, relax, everyone. That's not that big of a deal.
Right. It's still scary, though.
Yeah.
To think of.
Right.
Sheila continued her terrifying trek through the house, and in the bedroom right next to the living room, she found Rick, Greg, and their friend Justin. But something was different about these three kids. They were alive and unharmed and still sleeping. So, the big...
I just cannot even... imagine how unsettling that must have been.
I know.
Like, what? Like, I don't get it.
So the big question is, did they sleep through these murders? We shall touch upon that later. Still, one person was missing. It was the youngest daughter, Tina, and she was nowhere to be found. It would actually take police multiple hours to realize that Tina was missing in the first place. Bitch!
I know.
That is so insane to me. just all of that last part.
Yeah. It's unsettling, to say the least.
Imagine, like, walking in your house, seeing, like, half of your family is brutally murdered, and then two of your other brothers and their friend are just sound asleep in the next room.
Like, that does not add up at all.
It's very weird.
After discovering the scene, the mortified Sheila ran back to the Siebolds to try and explain what she had just seen at Cabin 28. The father of the Siebold family, James Siebold, ran back to Cabin 28, opened the window to the boys' bedroom, and pulled each of them out so they wouldn't see the gruesome scene that unfolded in the living room.
Good.
I know. Good man. It is said that James also entered the cabin through the back door to make sure that there was no one else alive in the house that needed help. The bad thing about this, of course, would be that some evidence might be tampered with if he touched something he shouldn't have. Like, obviously, if he opened the door, like, his fingerprints are going to be on there. But, like,
I mean, even just setting foot in the room, like,
yes, anything
can disturb things.
Right. And if he was going room to room, like, that's really not good.
Right.
About an hour after Sheila had first discovered the mangled bodies at 7 in the morning, law enforcement began to arrive. After trying multiple times to tell police that Tina was missing, the police finally believed Sheila, and the FBI was called in and arrived shortly after. Like, why did they not believe her?
That is so bizarre.
Oh, God, whatever.
Maybe they just, like, weren't so concerned.
But, like, they had. I know, but still.
But then again, I feel like they would be super concerned because they don't want a fourth victim.
Exactly. Doug Thomas was the sheriff at the time of the murders. He and his deputy, Lieutenant Don Stoy, were sent in to the scene first. When initially scoping out the scene, they were not able to determine a clear motive. This stumped the citizens living in other cabins and the rest of the investigative crew, because now this horrendous murder scene looked to be done by a complete stranger. They came to this conclusion initially because there was no forced entry, even though there was a fingerprint found on the back stairs of the house, and there was no sign of robbery in the house either. One of the weirder discoveries found at the scene would be that the phone on the wall of the house had been left off the hook, as if someone had tried to make a call. Would this have been the killer making the call, or one of the victims trying to make a call for help?
The thought of, like, one of them trying to make a call and then, like, being dragged back.
I know.
Or something.
Horrifying.
That's so scary.
The shades in the house were also drawn and all the lights had been shut off. Another strange aspect of the scene was that Tina's jacket and shoes were missing from her room, and a toolbox from the house was also missing. Although police initially suspected that there was no motive, it is clear to see that this was a targeted crime, and that whoever entered this house that night entered it with the intent of murder. Because you don't just leave two boys unharmed, three boys unharmed, and then just go on your day. It was also said that there was a lot of evidence found at the scene of the crime, but it was all pre-DNA testing, which turned out to not be helpful in the slightest.
Of course.
Right. And in the 80s, there really wasn't that great of DNA testing. So, great. Or really any DNA testing. So, basically,
how the fuck did they solve murders before DNA?
I think about that when I look at, like, murders in the 20s. It reminds me of that. I think John Mulaney does a sketch about that. Where he's...
I love him.
Me too. Where he's like, how did people solve murders around this time? And then he just, like, walks into a room and he's like, I don't even know. That's the dumbest way to describe that. But go.
I got
just,
it, though.
Just watch it, everyone. It's funny. If you don't know who John Mulaney is, leave.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Was she sexually assaulted?
The mom? I mean, yeah.
Wasn't she naked?
Yes, she was. But I didn't find any, like, thing that said she was.
Right.
But I feel like if you find that, like, if you find a person that way,
I mean, she was naked from the waist down and gagged with her underwear.
Right, it just leads
There's obviously a sexual motive there.
Right, whether or not. Right.
Anyways, okay.
Which is very, that's very unsettling to think about with Tina missing, too.
Exactly.
Right. So, there you go. So, who did it? Who did this?
Who did this?
Who done it?
It's a classic whodunit.
Anyways. The police began their interviews with the surrounding neighbors and the surviving members of the family. Both Sheila and the Seabolt family had heard nothing during the night. But can I just say, I saw photos of how close the houses were to each other at this resort, and I truly do not believe for a second that they didn't hear a peep from the screaming family next door. I mean,
literally, like, everyone go look it up. No, like, there's no way.
Well, also, like, there's no way that these murders were quick and fast and, like, they were sleeping and they didn't wake up. Like,
right.
I mean, someone couldn't, like, there's evidence that someone tried to make a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, obviously they were up and trying to get help.
There was a fight. I was just going to say that. Like, this is not, like, Villisca axe murder style where they're all asleep.
Exactly.
All of them had signs of struggle on their bodies, like, when their bodies were found. So, like, there would have been yelling. Like, no one's just going to be a silent fighter.
Exactly.
Like, that doesn't happen, really.
Imagine just, like, struggling with a killer and you're just completely silent.
That's fucked.
Also, backing up these suspicions would be that a couple that was living in another nearby cabin had said that at around 1:30 in the morning, they heard some muffled screams, but they weren't able to determine where it was coming from. Rick and Greg stuck to their story about being asleep during the murders. However, little Justin Smart said that he saw two men in the house that night with Sue. Although Justin changed his story multiple times, there must be at least a little truth to it, so I'm going to explain what he said. At one point, he said that he dreamt details about the murders, but then he soon changed his story when he was put under hypnosis in order to try and get details of the murder out of him. And this is what he said he saw and heard. To begin with, he said that he heard sounds from the living room while he was watching TV in the bedroom with Rick and Greg, so he went to investigate for himself. He said that one man had a mustache and long hair, and the other guy was clean-shaven with short hair and glasses. He also reported that one of the guys was carrying a hammer. Oh.
Cute.
That's good.
And specific.
Yeah.
Also, wait, can I just point out, like, is hypnosis used anymore?
Probably not.
That seems like...
You want to know something crazy, though?
Yeah.
So my mom is one of 9 children, and
wow.
For every birth that my grandmother birthed, she was put under hypnosis.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess it, like, made you not feel anything.
I don't think it. I don't think I would like that.
I don't either. I want to experience it.
Me too, even if it hurts like fuck.
Well, I'll get a nice needle in the back.
Oh, God.
An epidural.
I probably won't even need that with my pain tolerance. It's frightening.
Oh, my God. I would need it. Anyways, we are getting way off track here. Justin also told police that the oldest brother, John, and his friend Dana entered the house and were involved in a heated argument with the men in the house. And it turned into a violent fight. And one of the men ended up taking Tina out to the back of the cabin.
This is all very specific.
Right.
Like,
I'm really confused
If Justin is telling the truth, I mean, if he's not telling the truth, like, why did he make
this
all up?
Where is he
getting this? Right, exactly.
Right. I mean, wasn't he pretty young, too?
Yeah. He must have been around, like, Rick and Greg's age.
Sheriff Thomas called the Sacramento Department of Justice, who then sent 2 special agents from the Organized Crime Unit to Cabin 28. This struck many people as odd. Me being one of them, simply because they did not send the homicide unit into this triple homicide situation.
Like, what?
Like, where did the organized crime come
like,
in?
Like, I understand a little bit.
I don't. Were they involved with organized crime? Like, the family?
No.
So, the fuck?
I know. Doesn't make sense at all.
The Seabolts did tell police that they had seen a green van parked outside of the Sharps' house at about 9 p.m. that night. But other residents reported seeing a brown Datsun car outside of the Sharp house instead. The car reportedly had a tire that was almost completely flat. That's pretty specific.
Yeah.
One of the first suspects that the police interviewed was a man who had disappeared right after the murders had taken place, but he was later found in Oregon. However, once they interviewed him and later took a polygraph test, he was ruled cleared by the investigators. But as we know now,
more than ever.
Ugh.
Polygraphs mean jack shit.
It makes me so angry when I hear about cases that use a polygraph as, like, evidence against somebody.
I don't think anymore they can be used as, like, evidence in a court. I mean, I guess it's just, like, a way of, like, determining or, like, getting a feel for the person or whatever. But,
like,
not everyone has the same response. If you're a good enough
detective in a serious criminal investigation like this, you're going to walk into the investigation room and be like, that person's fucking lying. Like, you're going to know.
Yeah, because not everyone, like, has the same biological response.
Right. To lying and also, you can manipulate that stuff. You can.
Exactly.
So
people have done it.
Yeah. You know what's weird? A fun fact about me is that I can slow down my pulse. So
how do you do that?
I don't know. But my old roommate, Brianna, she was taking my pulse one time for her nutrition class or something like that. And she was like, what's happening? And whenever someone asks to take my pulse, I get really, really nervous for some reason.
Oh my God.
And so I was like really, really nervous. So I was like, okay, I just need to slow down my pulse. And I just, like, did it. And she was like, your pulse is really irregular. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's because I was doing it. And she was like, what the fuck?
That is so fun. So you could totally, like, pass a polygraph.
Yeah, probably. That's fucked.
Marilyn Smart, the mother of Justin, became a suspect for a few moments when she went to the police saying that she had found a small jacket in her basement and turned it in to the police. But strangely enough, no record of this jacket being turned in exists.
Weird.
It's bizarre.
Fucking 80s.
True. However, upon responding to this statement from Marilyn, some other faces popped into the sheriff's head. These names included Martin Smart, the stepfather of Justin Smart, and an ex-convict that was staying in his home named John Bobaday. Anyways, and he apparently had connections to organized crime. So I guess that's where it comes in, but still, that's a very, like,
why would you pick this one convict being like, oh, that's it? Why don't you call both of them?
Well, that's a very small connection to be made. Right. I don't think you would call the unit.
Right.
And to investigate.
Also, why can't you call both? Yeah, exactly.
Or maybe start with homicide, yeah, because it's a fucking homicide. Three.
A triple homicide.
It was reported that the two men had been seen wearing suits at a bar on the night of the murders, and they were acting strangely. Martin Smart told police that he owned a hammer that was similar to a model of one of the hammers found at the crime scene, and that he had noticed it gone missing a little bit before the murders happened. Sheriff Doug Thomas stated that Martin gave endless clues in the case in order to try and throw the suspicion off of himself.
So after interviewing and hypnotizing Justin Smart, the sketch artist had drawn up a sketch of the two mysteriously unknown men. Rumors started to spread about why these murders were committed in the first place. Some of the rumors suggested that it was ritualistic or related to drug trafficking, but this was quickly ruled out by the police because no drugs or evidence of drugs had been found in the house whatsoever. However, a family friend named Carla McMullen said that Dana Wingate, the friend of the oldest boy John, has stolen some LSD from some random local drug dealers. But this was not able to be confirmed, and I also just think that that isn't a big deal because he's a dumb 80s teenage boy. Like, obviously...
I mean, that wouldn't, I don't think, at least, warrant... Okay, we're gonna cut that out.
Oh my god.
I don't think that would warrant a triple homicide.
Agreed.
Great.
It also said before that he liked to party because him and John were going to a party in Quincy.
Right.
So I'm thinking, hello, he just likes to party.
Right, exactly.
It was also suspected for a while that maybe serial killers Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole were involved in the gruesome murders. But in December of 1983, they were eventually ruled out of the case entirely.
That's a cop-out.
I know. Agreed. With all of these different claims and suspects swirling around, the forces spent 4,000 hours on this case, but sadly there were still no leads. However, 3 years later, the Keddie murders had a very interesting development. About 30 miles away from Keddie, in a county called Butte, a human skull was found. Surrounding the skull was a child's blanket, a blue nylon jacket, a pair of jeans with the back pocket missing. I don't know what happened there. And an empty surgical tape dispenser. So, not looking good for Miss Little Tina over here.
Oh.
One of the creepiest parts of this discovery was that the Butte County Sheriff's Office also received a call that said, quote, "I wonder if they thought of the murder in Keddie up in Plumas County a couple years ago, where a 12-year-old girl was never found," end quote. Which is just creepy. I don't want any anonymous calls ever.
That is, like, a weird way to say that. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if they ever thought, like, you know what I mean?
It's just so pompous.
Right.
Like, he's just, whoever made this call is just being a dick about it.
Exactly. Obviously, they thought about it.
Right. Before this call, there were a bunch of different thoughts about who the remains could have belonged to. However, once this anonymous call was put in, the county was able to confirm that it was, in fact, the youngest daughter of the Sharp family, Tina. Poor Tina!
That is really sad.
Around the time that Tina's remains were found, Sheriff Thomas had resigned from the case entirely, saying that he had handled the case irresponsibly and in an almost disastrous way.
I would love to know what his reasons are for saying that.
I know. I wish he gave some, like, backing evidence on why he thought it was such a disaster.
Those are some pretty strong words there.
They are! Thomas!
What does it mean?
Tell us! Just a few years ago, in 2016, a hammer was found in a pond that resembled one of the hammers from the murders. When it was found, the Plumas County Sheriff said that it would have been put there intentionally in order to hide whatever it had been linked to. So that makes me wonder, like, was there a third weapon used? Like a third hammer?
Right.
And a person was, like, maybe when they were taking Tina away, did they just, like, chuck it in the pond?
Probably. I mean,
that just is so odd to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was never confirmed that it was a part of the case, though, right?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like they just assumed that because a weird, similar hammer to these murders was found in a pond, that it might have been
part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. But there was still no killer found yet. But whatever happened to Martin Smart? A few years after the murders, Martin drove to Reno, Nevada, where he sent a letter to Marilyn, his wife, stating things about their struggling marriage. But the ending of the letter was the most telling. He stated, quote, "I've paid the price of your love, and now I've bought it with 4 people's lives," end quote. That is so sinister! But that just makes you sound like the most guilty person in the world.
Yeah. I mean, why would you say that if you didn't have something to do with it?
Right. Oh, God. Finally, this is my favorite part of this case. I don't know why. But in April of 2018, Detective Gamberg, a detective now working on the case after the detectives had retired previously, stated that DNA was found on a piece of tape that was at the crime scene. Although he never stated who the DNA actually belonged to, he said that it matched with a living suspect. So, who was it? Was it Martin Smart? Those 2 random guys that Justin saw? Sheila and the Seabolts? Or someone completely different that no one had even thought of yet? Maybe those random serial killers.
That is so, like, ominous, just to say that.
He must know who did it.
Well, yeah, I mean, they know it belongs to a living suspect, so they know who it belongs to.
So I'm wondering, like, why isn't he saying it? Like, why isn't it? Maybe there's not enough evidence to
I bet they're trying to build a case.
Right, because you can't just say, oh, I found this evidence, this is the person that did it, because that's just not true.
Right, just off of one piece of tape.
For some reason, my initial thought when he said he found that DNA that matched it, it was like, it was Sheila, because she had discovered them in the first place. I wonder, like, did she touch the tape? I don't know.
But he called the person a suspect. Like, was Sheila ever a suspect?
Everyone. I don't think so. I think everyone is technically a suspect.
Well, yeah, I guess.
So, I don't know. I mean, she had to be a suspect because it's her family. And even mm-hmm. though she had an alibi, it would be the same alibi that the Seabolts have. And if the Seabolts are suspects, then she's a suspect.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
But in my opinion, it was Martin.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm going to explain my theory on why I think it's Martin and what he did. And then if you have one, feel free to jump off of that.
Great.
So I think we both think that
we do both think
Martin and Sue were having an affair. Then Marilyn, his wife, found out about this said affair. And she was basically like, bitch, do something about this, you dumb fuck. And so Martin was like, okay, I guess I gotta kill Sue. And because I obviously jumped to that conclusion as well when I am in that situation. So he goes to attack Sue. And then her son, John, sees this happening. He's like, oh my God, I gotta defend my mom here. And so he starts to fight back. And then basically Martin kills both of them in the same way. With the throat mm-hmm. slitting, all of that situation. He kills them. And then little Dana over here sees this whole situation happening too. And he's like, oh my God, I got to kill this kid now. And in this like rushed attempt, he strangles Dana. Because mm-hmm. his was in a different way than everybody else. And then I initially thought, and I think we both initially thought that, I mean, no, you thought something different. But I think that maybe it was Marilyn that was also there because she maybe could have taken Tina away. And mm-hmm. she was just like, come here, Tina. Because she was, like, alive and in the house still. And I think that they saw... Oh, the thing that boggles my mind about this whole freaking case is the boy sleeping.
Yeah, that is just so bizarre.
But basically, I think that Marilyn and Martin were in cahoots and they killed Tina. Or, like, I think Martin still killed Tina, but he just did it later.
I agree with that, mostly. But I wonder if that ex-convict who was living with them
mm-hmm.
was just, like, helping Martin out. Like, right. maybe, like, I do think the plot was Marilyn's, like, influence.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if, like, Martin was like, I gotta do this. And, like, the ex-convict was just like, all right, dude, I'll help.
Yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you on that one. I wonder if somebody drugged the boys.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I wonder
if they were ever tested for that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That would make sense.
Yeah, I guess I don't.
But then again, why wouldn't they drug Dana and John?
Well, maybe because... Oh, God, I don't know. That's so bizarre. It's the boys sleeping that I cannot figure out. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Maybe the boys, like, snuck out. And they were lying about that. They didn't want to say that they snuck out that night. And then, like, snuck back in later through the window.
Right. I don't know.
But that's just so bizarre. I don't get it. But that's how I feel about it.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, that's it, everyone. That is the Keddie Cabin murders. It's creepy. You can also still go to the resort, but it's completely shut down. And the house that was Cabin 28 was completely demolished, so you can't go because people used to like squat there and just like chill out there and they think it was fun. And I understand, I feel like a lot of abandoned houses have that happen anyway, but it was completely destroyed in 2004, so you can't go and stay there anymore. And but the resort, like the whole setup, is still there, and all the other houses are still there basically, so you can go. BuzzFeed Unsolved did an episode there. And they actually went and looked at it, which I don't think I would like to do that. I don't know if I... There must be spirits there. Like, good God.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't like, demolish a house that people were murdered in and expect their souls to be like, oh, sure.
I'll leave.
Yeah. But anyway, that is that. If you want to visit, go visit. Let me know how it goes. And don't get killed, please. But
let us know if you have any different theories on this case.
Yes.
And what your thoughts are, because I would love to hear them.
Yes, you can tell us at our Instagram. You can DM us on Instagram at Spook Me Podcast.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. Or you can email us at spookmepod@gmail.com. Tell us your thoughts, who you think did it. Tell us your ghost stories if you have any, but don't lie. And then tell us if you want to hear anything else, or you just want to tell us a nice little fun fact about something. That's it.
Sounds wonderful.
And we will be back on Monday for some creepy Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yes, we will.
Amityville. I'm so excited. Speaking of gruesome family murders.
Literally. That's a good segue.
I know. It's a good thing we didn't do Villisca and then Amityville.
That would have just been...
It would have been too much.
Too much.
Too much axe wielding.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we will see you on Monday.
Thank you for listening.
Goodbye. Bye.